204 DGS on KMOX. So my mom is in a rehab, has been for a month now. Yeah, well, she's been in hospitals and rehabs and going to a long-term facility soon. But she's been in one bed. She's been in a bed for 4 weeks now, and she's not in a great mood. And so this morning, went to see her. I'll go see her again this afternoon, and I'm taking the brunt of the anger. And it made me think, though, that let's say I live the same amount of time, you know, she's 37 years older than me. If I live that long, I won't be yelling at my kids. I will be yelling at holograms of my kids or a robot that has been hired to take care of me, right?
An AI.
Yeah, or an AI. Yeah. I mean, I'm not even kidding.
No.
Within 30 years? You kidding me? Musk thinks we're all going to have robots within 10. Like Rosie the Robot on the Jetsons. Like Millennial Man with Robin Williams.
Right.
We're going to have a servant in our home within 10 years.
We have a lot of that already that's just not a physical embodiment, right? I mean, you have voice-activated, you know, things through Amazon. I don't want to say the names because I don't want to set people's devices off. But you can just say, hey, lady's name, you know.
You can pretty easily... can get those plugs that like basically will turn your house into a smart house where off an app on your smartphone, you can just turn on your TV, adjust your thermostat, turn on the lights.
I think bottom line is going to be better for us.
Hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if they're not going to do stuff like healthcare worker or, you know, assisting with healthcare, then why are we even doing this? Yeah. I mean, that seems like the reason to do it is to support people through difficult times.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, if we're doing it so something can retrieve your golf ball for you, that seems...
Oh, and that'll come first, too, because there will be a demand for it right away.
Yeah.
Right?
Stairway?
Well, I don't know if you did this on purpose, Dave, but I have a couple of AI stories that are a little different, like the plus and the minus of it, so it kind of ties into what we're talking about. So there's the cool side, and then there's the scary side. Which side do you want first?
Cool.
Cool side. So scientists that are studying, like, historical sites and things along. They've been studying like the life of Plato and the death of Plato, and they've found a bunch of writings from his time that have been almost indecipherable because of damage and wear and tear. Well, AI has helped them fill in a lot of the blanks. So now we know more. Like, he hated the music that was being played while he was on his deathbed.
I saw that.
Right? Like, think about how cool that is. We are learning about things from so long ago. Because of AI, it's solving a problem that we otherwise have not been able to solve for all of this time. And it's teaching us something important about a very important person. Like, we know more now about when he was actually sold into slavery as opposed to, you know, what we thought it was and where he's buried. We might have a better idea of exactly where it is now rather than just vaguely where it is. So a mystery from that long ago is helped by AI.
It's cool.
It's a solution.
AI recently found a new version of the Book of Matthew in one of the oldest transcripts.
Oh.
So it's arguably the Matthew because it was like under what we think of as being the Book of Matthew.
Okay, right.
And it wasn't any great shakes. It was when Jesus is walking and they're picking the wheat and you're not supposed to do that on the Sabbath. And it was just the difference between how the alliteration of it.
Okay.
But still, finding something that was decades before, that's really fascinating.
Right.
And there's no possible way we would have done it without AI.
Right. And there's, think about all the other, like some of the, and I know that we've figured out a lot of the old languages, but there are still texts that we haven't solved. There are still like codes that we haven't solved. People who wrote things in code so that they would be able to, AI is going to help solve a lot of these things. Then on the other side of that, I saw a story that in the not too distant future, the expectation is that AI is going to read our emotions because they'll be able to listen to our voice and the variations in our voice that we perceive, but not as well as the AI will. Combine that with watching our facial expressions. And essentially, we'll be able to tell if we're faking it or not, like when we're pretending to be happy or when we're lying about something. And I don't like that.
I don't like that either.
I don't like that one bit. Like, how do you, I don't know, maybe the world changes and we just stop disguising what we actually think. I mean, like, say, is that the natural result of that being a thing? If someone can hold their phone up and AI thing is looking at you while you're talking, and now they're going to be able to tell.
Ricky Gervais has a great movie called The Invention of Lying, where in this obviously invented world, no one had ever lied before. and he told the first lie. He goes to withdraw money from his account, and he says $3,000, and the lady says, oh, I'm sorry, you only have $800. And he goes, I think I have $10,000. And she goes, oh, okay, well, here you go. And it's brilliant. But what if we're living in the opposite? What if in 20 years it's you can't lie? Because everyone has a little smartwatch that can tell, like, hey, come
read
on, Rachel.
Read your facial tics, yeah, or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
And everyone just has to tell the truth.
Boy. Okay, so, like, this is why I wanted to bring that story up. A, it's the up and the positives and possible negatives of AI. Because there's both. We know both exist, right? AI could solve problems. Could solve cancer, could solve a lot of things, but it can also bring some of these other things. So if it gets to that, better or worse for us?
Worse.
If you basically can't BS people.
I started to say worse, but I don't know. I mean, if you couldn't lie, then you would just have to live your life differently.
It's kind of like, I mean, I know the comedy version of it is Jim Carrey's Liar, Liar, mm-hmm. right? Where he just cannot lie for that period of time. But is that better for all of us? Even if it creates some tension that currently doesn't exist because we can kind of hide things.
I think sometimes you lie to save someone's feelings.
Yes.
And that is very intimidating to think that you wouldn't be able to do that. And it's just like everyone knows exactly what you're thinking at all times. That's kind of not okay.
Do we?
Because we have like a right to privacy. Yeah, at a certain point, it is invading
and
your privacy.
That would be a really interesting legal case. Yeah, let's say that they invent it and someone sues and says, you are invading my privacy of thought.
Well, doesn't it totally upend the entire legal system? Like if a lawyer is representing somebody that they know...
Trying to spin the case?
Yeah, know committed the crime, but they're saying, I'm going to prove that my client didn't do it.
Yeah.
They would be unable to prove that
They couldn't hide it.
Yeah, they wouldn't be able to hide anything.
I think we are going to see so many people not reject AI, but I think we're going to have these like organic spaces where it's like, hey, I had a real interaction the other day because I went to the real cafe where you're not allowed to bring in your thingamajig.
Yeah, I could see AI-free towns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We just don't do it here.
Because they have towns that like don't have any internet, don't have any Wi-Fi or cell phone signal because people claim they can feel that in their bodies. I mean, there are some people that are just like hypersensitive to it, so they move to these certain areas without it. I think we'll see a lot of people being like, especially older people, I think, just saying, I don't want anything to do with this. It's too foreign to what I'm used to.
Mm-hmm.
Does it, because I think the legal question is probably the toughest hurdle to get over when we're talking about giving someone their fair defense, right? But if we know whether you did it or not,
it's like Minority Report.
Nah, yeah. I mean, in that sense, it's a little
cut down on crime.
But this is what I was asking is, do people not do things that we currently do? And
100%.
Is that not the definition of justice? If you cannot hide what you did.
Yeah.
If you committed a crime, the AI will. I'm not saying I want this. I'm saying this would be what it is. Like if the AI is proven to be good enough to be able to say no, that's not true. That's a lie. Here's all the data, and that's it. But then we're putting a lot of trust in a machine or into an algorithm, as opposed to actually taking physical evidence and compiling it and putting it together.
Do you know of any movies that have dealt with that? It seems like an awfully interesting concept to put into a movie.
Yeah, I don't know that I can think of anywhere that's like the core concept. There may have been a few where it's like...
I never saw Minority Report. Is it something like that?
Well, so that one was what the humans were called, the precogs, where they had visions and they could see crimes before they happened, but it was enough to arrest you. You are being arrested for a future crime.
It's fairly
similar.
That
you haven't committed, but if we don't arrest you, you will commit it.
We don't have proof that you committed this crime, but the AI is telling us that you did.
It's telling us that you're lying.
That you're lying.
When you say you didn't. I mean, again, we have lie detector tests now, but there's a reason they're not the be-all, end-all, right? I mean, they're
do
barely
you guys feel like
a tool.
You could beat one?
I don't know. Probably.
I think I would fail when they asked my name and I said Rachel Zimmerman. I would be so nervous.
Yeah. Is my name Rachel?
Yeah, because it's all like heart rate, right? Like, I'm already so nervous if you've got me connected to my heart rate.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, if I didn't tell a single lie, I'd feel like I failed.
Yeah.
I know I did.
I mean,
you
people
seem to be
beat
lying
it, right?
Before being asked
a
question.
There are different strategies.
Right, because there are things where you do where you actually work yourself up on purpose so that when you stay level, you don't go up when you do get actually nervous.
And there's one that I've heard of that some people can do where they have the mental control that they ask you one question. Were you at the scene of this crime? But you, in your mind, think of a different question.
And you're answering a separate question.
And you're answering a separate question.
And I'm sure that, like, sociopaths can pass them. Because they're not...
There was, like, a
experiencing famous, this in the same way the rest of us are.
It was, like, a pretty high-profile case, right, where... I can't think of what it is, but they passed the lie detector test, and pretty much everybody was like, well, he shouldn't have... Like, he definitely, you know, because he was, like...
Like,
proven,
they didn't believe him.
Well, and he was, like, proven to have been lying, but he passed the lie detector test.
I mean, that's the reason why they're not admissible, right? You can do them, but they're not going to be like, this is, they can't be the foundation of your, of a conviction. It doesn't prove anything because it can be beaten. It's imperfect.
Until the technology that you're talking about comes around.
I mean, but I, what, we would have to have some kind of like absolute proof that it can't be wrong though, right?
Right.
And what would that look like?
Yeah. And how do you obtain that absolute truth? You kind of can't.
Right.
Because no one, that's the thing, is no one knows what another person is truly thinking. That's
not
part
today.
Of, that's part of being human.
Right.
Yeah, but think about it. We have people who are controlling things with their brain, and we can translate what someone's thinking in a rudimentary way.
Mm-hmm.
When it's no longer rudimentary, if the police, their interrogation is now just putting an electrode on your head and asking you questions, and they can literally print out
read
what
your mind.
Yeah.
Wheels, did your story say what the context would be for these, for this technology?
Yeah, it wasn't a doom story. It was just a like, this is what, these are the things that it's going to be able to do to help you when you're asking it to do something.
Well, even we're going to the ultimate dramas of
right,
murder.
Right, right.
Just buying a car.
Right.
You know, negotiating over anything. Asking someone out on a date.
It'd be like, would you, the Ricky Gervais movie.
Yeah.
I don't have $10,000. Yes, you do.
Yes, you do.
Now, baby, would I shout out the store?
Man, this is a good album.
It's the one of the best ever made.
Top 10. So
that's
great.
One of my favorites right there, too.
Oh, yeah. Rach, you want to tell us about your new life in tennis?
I've been playing tennis
You've
lately,
been wearing
you guys.
A tennis top.
Well, this is kind of just the, what the. This is a little.
What the kids are wearing?
Right, yeah, I didn't want to say it, but it is true. I've started playing tennis it's been about a month of playing like kind of regularly, and I'm really, really bad, but I'm getting better. But it's just interesting. I was never like much of an athlete growing up at all. So to try to learn those skills in your 30s is kind of difficult and challenging, but it's very rewarding at the same time. It's teaching me a lot of patience, and it's teaching me like to just not get embarrassed and not want to quit because I feel stupid. I'm big on that. I'm like, oh, I look like an idiot. I just don't want to do it anymore. But I realize that if I do that, I'm never going to get better, and I really want to get better.
Rach said something today in the office, which I hadn't really thought of. For people like us, that all we did was play sports. We have, like, if we were her age, we would have 30 years of athleticism, whether it was playing tag or playing baseball or wrestling or whatever it was. We would have a real library of here's how you move your body.
Mm-hmm.
But Rach hadn't done that. She just lived a different kind of life.
Right.
And so when we would think, like, just hit the freaking ball, like, oh, come on. I mean, I don't expect you to be an expert, but just hit the ball. But if you don't have that language, sort of like Mike Johnston, the drummer, drum teacher was talking about, if you don't have the language of drums, you can't play the drums.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just learning, like the classic split step in tennis, like, just be on your feet, be bouncing back and forth. That is not something that comes naturally to me.
Right.
I'm getting it now, and it's becoming more natural now the more I do it. But at first, I'm just, like, standing there, like, waiting for the ball to come to me, which sounds insane if you're an athlete. But, if you didn't grow up doing it, it's tough. And it is, you know, I do wish I would have gotten involved with this as, like, a teenager or younger. But because your brain is just so much more pliable, your body's more pliable, and also you're less scared of looking stupid. Like, mm-hmm. Like my boyfriend Kurt is the one like helping me get better at tennis, and he always says to me, he's like, "Stop worrying about what you look like when you're a little kid. Like, kids look stupid when they're trying to do stuff."
That's
but
exactly
it,
right.
It we never, all
they just don't care.
Yeah, they don't care. It never crosses their mind to be embarrassed or to be ashamed or anything. Yeah. So just go for it, and it's very valuable advice.
I was thinking about that, like. Like Jimmy Griffin is obviously gifted. He's special playing guitar, but he didn't pick up a guitar and shred. He had to pick up a guitar and make a G chord, and it was awkward. Everyone starts somewhere, and people advance faster when you're really talented, but no one just kills it from the beginning.
Yeah, with sports, I'd be willing and able and comfortable trying just about anything. But it wouldn't matter what. I mean, I know there are things I can't do. Like, I couldn't do gymnastics. I can't do the rings.
Yeah, ditto.
Now, at 30, maybe I could have done it and still hurt myself, but I would be willing to try it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do anything with music. Mm. Nothing. What you're talking about, if I did music and tried to sing or play an instrument, that's where I'm at. I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how this works. And that's totally normal when you don't have background.
Like Andrew with farting. He's only done it once.
I've done it one time in front of Kevin, and Kevin's like, oh, this is dirt on him forever.
What's your thing on this, Dave? The thing that you just don't have any footing? Because you've got music.
Building anything.
Okay. Right. Handiwork.
Anything mathematical.
Okay.
I have a lot. We could be the show.
This is my point, really, is that everybody has more of those than they have the things that they're really good at.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we all do. There's so many things. Like, same thing with you. I can't fix an engine. I don't even know it. I mean, I know the gas goes in here, and I know the oil goes there, but I don't.
To give you an idea, in seventh grade, we had to, and this is something, the girls had to take home ec, and the boys had to take shop. Had to.
Well, you got
to
prepare for your future lives.
And it was a year long, and we did wood shop, we did print shop, we did metal shop, and we did small engine repair. And so each quarter was one of those. And I was in a group of four guys, and we had a lawnmower engine, and we had to take it apart and put it back together. And then for the final exam, they asked the teacher, who, by the way, was Catfish Hunter's brother, if I could sit out during the exam. And he said yes.
Oh, Dave.
234 DGS. I have a couple of weird thoughts. This is TikTok based, but I saw a TikTok where a guy found a baby deer, young deer, not baby, but a young deer that had been shot in the hip with an arrow, removed the arrow, took it to the vet, and then raised it like a dog. And it acts like a dog, and it like cuddles with the kids and kisses the kids. And first of all, I wanted a deer once I saw that. But it makes you wonder, are most animals domesticatable? We just don't.
I think most that are not the bitey kind, right? The predators, no. The ones that are not predators, I think so, right? I mean, I've seen examples of people that have like, I know it's in the movie with...
Free Willy.
No, you'll know. The donkey pet. The pet donkey with...
Shrek.
No.
Banshees of Inisherin.
Banshees of Inisherin. Yeah, like...
Shrek.
Shrek. Donkey! They're all kinds of those types of animals that are, they're always the quote unquote non-predators.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be a little bit more worried about anything that kills to eat.
And then I saw something recently. It was so moving. It was an old Robin Williams, probably within a year of his death, and Philip Seymour Hoffman. And they were discussing life, and they were both so depressed.
Yeah.
And then Seinfeld, who's one of the richest guys in the world, most successful, and I was reading some of his quotes where he's talking about, and I just had therapy yesterday with my therapist, Brett, and he was talking about reading that article and kind of making the point that money really maybe doesn't buy happiness. I mean, it's better with than without. I've lived both ways. But I guess there's no amount of money that satisfies, which is very biblical and very going back to, you know, thousands of year old Chinese proverbs. But I think we just learn it every generation.
Yeah, it solves some problems, but it can't change how your brain works. And it can't change what you've experienced in the past.
I think it can save you from agony.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it doesn't fulfill you to the point where you're like, I am just so incredibly content.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, again, what happened before still happened.
Yeah.
You know, and that's still a part of you. But I mean, good or bad doesn't really matter either way. Right? Like, that's still there. It doesn't just go away because you can write every check you need
to
write.
Robin Williams was probably not a Seinfeld level guy, but I'm sure he had $100 million or more.
Oh, yeah.
He had all the money he needed.
Yeah.
And he wasn't ranting, but in his own Robin Williams way, he was just like, this can't be all there is. This can't be what, if there's a God, what God intended. This can't be what it is because it's just so unfulfilling.
It was interesting, and I was telling Andrew this pre-show, actually, so it's weird that this came up without us coordinating it, but there was a, it may have been TikTok, it may have been Twitter, but there was a video of a person that was a child actor. I can't remember if it was on Mrs. Doubtfire, but it was on a movie where Robin Williams was the star.
Oh, I know
who
you mean. It's the little Lawrence kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was talking about how when he's on set, he's just energy and fun and crazy. And then he would go back to his dressing room and would just sit with his hands in his head, or his head in his hands, and just sit there and like not talk and kind of be in a dark place. And he said there were times that he would go in there to check on him because he thought, hey, this is a fun guy. We can go talk. And he would just say, listen, like, this is what I am more often. And something along the lines of also like, this is what all the drugs did to my brain. Because obviously in the 70s and 80s, he was doing everything in sight. And he talked about and joked about it on stage. And it's just fascinating that you have the two things, right? When the lights are on, you're on stage, you're on set, and it's time. You're Robin Williams. You are the one that everybody sees. Mm-hmm. But the minute you go off stage and get into a closed space, you can't get away from what's still driving you nuts.
So let's do a couple of audios. This first one is one of the things that makes me depressed. This is Drew Barrymore interviewing Kamala Harris.
I've been thinking that we really all need a tremendous hug in the world right now.
Yeah.
But in our country, we need you to be Mamala of the country.
When you make Kamala Harris feel weird,
I know that's why I left all that on there because you can hear her like Kamala going like,
Do it one more time just for the pain.
I don't know if I can take it.
I've been thinking that we really all need a tremendous hug in the world right now.
Yeah,
but in our country, we need you to be Mamala of the country.
Oh my God. And they cheered for
she
that.
She has a show.
They cheered for that.
So much bigger than ours.
Probably making $1 million an episode.
Easy.
And you want to talk about, like, happiness. I got to give it to Drew Barrymore. She seems like one of the happiest people on the planet.
Well, she doesn't see it.
What would she have to be sad about?
Well,
I mean, she had her childhood demons. I mean, she was like an alcoholic at 12 or something.
Well, I know, but I just mean,
When you think about, like, that personality that you see from her, right? Because she's, like, bubbly, and you're all of our friends. Remember what the image was forever of Ellen?
Right.
And then you start hearing the behind the scenes, what a monster she was to people, how terrible she was to people. And now she's doing stand-up and, like, basically mad that that all went away. Like, you were mean to people all the time, and you pretended to be super nice. Sorry, you got what you got.
This next piece of audio, very different. This is Mayor Eric Adams in New York, who's a very liberal guy, giving some very seemingly non-liberal thoughts.
We strongly believe that is the case right now, that there are people who are here, they latch on to any protest. To see our police officers having bottles thrown at them, chairs. People who peacefully protest for an issue, they're not throwing bottles and chairs. And so we know that we have acknowledged and saw across the country, there are people who come, have nothing to do with the issue, and they want to aggravate. What I believe is a number of people who are really trying to use this to cause violence in our city. And we're going to seek them out. And we're going to identify them. And I think Commissioner...
what do you think?
I mean, I don't think that's like necessarily a conservative or a liberal talking point. He's just pointing out that once you stop peacefully protesting, people are going to stop being sympathetic to what you're doing. President Biden just said the same thing. Michael's been playing it at the top of the hour news, but he's like, you know, if you're disrupting classes, if you're keeping people from graduating, if you're blocking and occupying buildings, like, you are taking it a step farther than we are willing to support you.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that has been a reality at almost every protest in the last handful of years, that there are people that are legitimately protesting and then there are other people that just want to fight. They just want chaos. I mean, as an example, why is the founder of the Proud Boys at Columbia University? Why is Gavin McInnes there?
I didn't know he was.
Yeah, he showed up there yesterday. Why is he there? You think he's there to make it better? You think he's there to calm things down?
Mm-hmm.
He's there for two reasons. Because he's hoping chaos erupts, and because now he's in the news again because he showed up at Columbia University. That is not a protest filled with people that are Proud Boys, right?
Are we seeing, this is a very existential question, but in this case, are we seeing violence over ideas, or are we seeing violence over violence, do you think? Like, for example, the pro-Palestinian protesters, are they, to the extent that they're being violent, are they doing so because they have a difference of ideas with Israelis, or is it because they are pushing back against what they consider to be Israeli violence? Because I don't understand violence over ideas. Now, I know that's age old. I know that goes all the way back.
Right.
But it just seems so sad that we would have violence over ideas.
I think it's violence over violence. I think the protests that you see, I mean, you see the word genocide used a lot. I think that's what the, it's not the idea of genocide. I think that they are, I Amy and I had a conversation about this in the office earlier. I think that a lot of these, now whether these kids are 100% correct about everything that they're protesting, they're young. They're stupid. I think they're probably not 100% informed on every possible issue. But I think they go on Twitter and they see one half of a Palestinian kid over here and one half over there across the street. And they go, this has to stop. I can't see this every day. I can't look at this. And I think when you say, so maybe that's not what you mean when you say.
No, it is.
Okay. Yeah. So I think what they're protesting is not like political machinations. I think what they're protesting is just straight up the violence that they have seen.
I think that's correct, but I also think that it's a, and I know people hate this, but whatever, but it's a very small percentage of people that are doing these things. If all of the protesters were violent, they would overrun the police because there are way more of them. And there are violent people in there that are lashing out, throwing chairs, throwing bottles, throwing things. And then what's that going to do? It's going to get a reaction, because if I get hit, if I'm a police officer and I'm getting hit by something, I'm going to react, try to find the person that did it and arrest them. Well, there are 20 people in front of me that are now in the middle of it, and there's going to be physical contact. So what's going to happen there? It's going to escalate, because then your survival instincts kick in and your anger kicks in, and that's what kickstarts it. I don't think the majority at any protest, whether it was the anti-Vietnam protests in the 60s and early 70s to any that we've seen since, I don't think the majority of the people in those situations want to fight. But I do think that there are people that want it, and they're in there, and they start it, and then it's like a forest fire going up.
Time to talk to our pal, Rick Horton. Rick, how you doing, buddy?
I'm great, Dave. How about you?
Not doing too bad. So May 8th is KMOX Day at the ballpark, and you can get yourself your very own Ricky and Rooney bobblehead. Rick, have you seen them yet?
I have seen them. In fact, it's kind of cool looking, and it's kind of humbling to have a bobblehead. It's kind of like one of those kind of cool deals, and I'm very very excited about that. It's going to be fun, and of course, you know, we love KMOX and our partnership with KMOX, and it'll be a fun day.
I had a client, ThrottleNet, made a bobblehead of me, and I'm telling you, if that bobblehead robbed a bank, I would go to jail.
Well, you know, I must say, Dave, and I will tell you very very openly, and all of your listeners, that there were some iterations of the bobblehead that were a little less flattering. So you kind of get a little, you kind of get the ability to say, nah, that's not quite me, and then you kind of get the changes done. So, we're both very happy with it, and again, honored.
All right, Ricky, so we're looking ahead, obviously. No, that'll be next week with the Mets in town. The homestand kicks off tomorrow against the White Sox, and I don't know how much you've seen of the White Sox, but you certainly know what they've been this year. They're on pace for 131 losses. What's reasonable for a team like the Cardinals to expect, right? Because the old line is, hey, they're getting a paycheck too. You can't take anybody lightly. But, you know, you look at the series and you're like, well, you want to win them, but you can't always place demands on it. Is this one where you're like, we better win this one?
I 100% agree with that. I think you better win this one. I think, well, let's say you should win that. I mean, again, stuff happens. But yeah, I mean, the expectations would be to do that. They do have Tommy Pham now, former Cardinal. That's kind of their hot player. But and also Paul DeJong, who I kind of root for every other series but this one, because I'm still a big fan of Paulie. I love him. But, you know, the White Sox are clearly, you know, struggling and their pitching's not great. And you know, they're tied for last in Major League Baseball in home runs. And guess who they're tied with?
Surprise me.
Yeah. They wear red. They wear red is all I'll say.
Yeah. It's been, and I wonder if anything you're seeing at the ballpark every day, Rick. I mean, I've been there, but I haven't been there every day like you. I'm seeing it on TV, so yeah, it's a little different experience. Is there any connecting reason, or is this just as simple as the two big fellas who hit a lot of home runs are not, and that's the result?
Yeah, and I would almost say three big fellas that aren't hitting home runs, because I'd throw Nolan Gorman into that. I mean, the expectation is that he would hit 25 or 30, and, you know, he's struggling. And, you know, there's not a reason to think that they're not going to figure it out. And it's just really, again, unfortunate that all three of them just do not have the right timing. Although, you know, Goldie's timing got better, certainly in that series. He had five hits in a row. I mean, what do you want? I mean, now is he hitting home runs? No. But you know, certainly, you know, better in terms of his timing. And you're not going to hit home runs if your timing's not good. You just are not. And you don't load right. You don't kind of have the right swing and the right plane and all that. So I think he's getting closer for sure.
So talk about it from a pitcher's perspective. I mean, that's obviously the goal of every pitcher, is to disrupt the timing and the rhythm of those hitters. And obviously we're seeing that. And the question, I guess, is, and this is why hitting is so hard, how do you get out of it?
Well, I mean, it's a feel thing. I mean, it's like, how do you start putting better? You know, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Everybody doesn't golf, but I like to go to golf because I think a lot of people play golf and they realize, man, this is tough. And, you know, you putt good one day, and the next day you're putting a ball off the green into a sand trap. And it's like, well, wait a minute, where did that happen? What happened there? And it's such a feel thing. So, I mean, to me, it's all about feel.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you can get inundated with numbers and swing plane and details, blah, blah, blah. But, hitting is a feel thing. And, by the way, so is pitching.
Rick, it's so interesting you brought that up. I was just about to ask you my Dave question, which today was going to be, I know that nerds like Wheeler and Gould and Ranji, they love the metrics. I know that coaches love it. But I wondered if the players were all in on it, or if you had some old school guys who are like, look, I don't want to know what my exit velocity is. I don't want to know this and this. I just want to go out there and play the game.
Well, I think they're in between what you just said. I think they appreciate those numbers. I think they appreciate the fact that people are taking deep dives into saying this is what we see from the numbers point of view. But then it's up to the artist to figure it out. I mean, they're artists. And it's like, you know, Van Gogh, your paintings aren't very good lately. And here's what we see. I mean, but you can't become Van Gogh. I mean, the artist is the player. And so you take the information and then you kind of cull it down to kind of what you can use. And I think that's what players like. I mean, they all like the information, Dave, but they don't want to be like all in terms of that's all what they're thinking about. They have to use that information prior and then adapt that into what they feel.
Man, that's such a great Dave question, because you bring this up with music all the time, right? Like, you take, we talked to Steve Vai last week. He's a great, you know, rock guitarist, Rick. And like, you can give him the same song that Eddie Van Halen played, and he can play it,
yeah,
but it doesn't sound the same. And it's the same idea, right? Of like, you know, there's a plan, but
it's one of the problems with us so focused on numbers. You know, I give the example of last time Sonny Gray pitched, and I'm looking forward to watching him pitch again.
Yeah.
Last time he pitched, I did not mention miles per hour one time during the broadcast, not one single time. I didn't care. Because why? Because he was pitching. He was an artist. He was going in and out and up and down. Now, his velocity was fine, and it was good, that's not a problem. But the point is, it wasn't the point of emphasis, and I think that's kind of where we got to get to, is kind of focusing on the right thing, which is, how do you pitch well? Stay out of the middle of the plate, change speeds, up and in, down and away. I mean, that's been pitching since 1885.
And Sonny Gray Day is tomorrow, by the way, for everybody that wants to know when he's going out. It'll be on Friday.
That's
and just to back you up, Rick, Sonny Gray is in the bottom third of Major League Baseball in fastball velocity, and he's got a 1.16 ERA. And all the numbers that we like to look at say that his ERA should be around 2, which is phenomenal. So bottom third in velo, but he is elite in performance.
Bottom third in velo, I think we should release him. Let's get rid of him. He's no good. let's get a guy that can throw 100. Well, you know, honestly, hey, I like guys that throw 100, especially in the bullpen, by the way. I mean, you like that, but the question is, can you teach a guy that throws 100 how to pitch? I think that's an open question in baseball. I think that's where we are in the sport, is trying to understand, can you take raw talent and make that guy a pitcher? Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Ricky, you guys enjoy your day today.
Yeah, you guys too.